Hear that tradition, the Masorah, consists of two parts. There's a written part and an oral part. The written part usually thought of as the Tanakh, the Bible. The oral part is usually thought of as everything else. I think that's a mistake. I think the whole dimension is being left out. There's one thing that the written and oral have in common. What they have in common is words. Words, sentences, paragraphs, chapters, books. From the point of view of words, it really doesn't matter whether the words are shapes of ink on parchment or patterns of neural organization in your brain. In the end, it's all words. What I want to talk to you about tonight is an aspect of the Masorah, of the tradition, that is not verbal. It's not composed in words. I used to say that it couldn't be composed in words. And I had an argument to prove it. But many years ago, one of the students showed me my argument was wrong. So I don't say it anymore. What I say is, we couldn't use it in words. If there is a verbal formulation, it would involve millions and millions of words, and it would be of no use to us. Whether there is theoretically a verbal formulation is a nice issue that I don't know how to adequately solve. From our point of view, it is and will remain nonverbal, and therefore it's very important for us to know where it comes from, and how it's learned, and how it's applied, and what its validity is. So what I'm going to do tonight is three things. First of all, I'm going to give you evidence from within Torah sources that there is such a thing. Then I will discuss briefly the general status of the nonverbal. It used to be that there was a terrible prejudice against the nonverbal. When I was in college, we were taught all thought is in language. If you can't say it, you can't think it. And if you think you think it, thinking it, you make a mistake. So I'm going to talk about the general status of the nonverbal and try to show you that the nonverbal can be valid, true, correct, justified, and so forth and so on. And then we will talk about where it's found, how it's learned, how it's applied, and what its implications are. So let's start with the first. Sources within the Torah that there is some nonverbal component to the tradition. It's a great idea. Could open it on the other side as well and get some fresh air. No, no. Thank you very much. There is a verse in Deuteronomy that says, "You shall do what is straight and good in God's eyes." I think it's in chapter 6. She said, "Yosha Matov Ben Hashem, do what is straight and good in God's eyes." Now, what is that? We have lots of mitzvos, 613. In general, and endless details under them. Does this verse command you to do something else? Or is it a way of summing up all the other ones? What is it doing? So the Ramban on this verse has a very striking, surprising, almost shocking comment. He says this verse is talking about interpersonal relations. Family, friends, neighbors, organization, society, state. And he says, it is impossible in principle to write down a complete set of rules governing interpersonal relations. Impossible in principle. This is a comment on a verse in the book of Deuteronomy. The author of the book of Deuteronomy is God. And Maimonides is saying it's impossible in principle to write down. I mean, he's talking about God, right? By God, what he means is, even if you had all the rules, there would be tens of thousands of them. And it wouldn't do us any good. Therefore, says Maimonides, God chose a double strategy. First of all, he wrote down a minimal set of rules. Minimum standards up to which everyone has to live. And then he says, don't be satisfied with the minimum standard. In addition to all the rules that I gave you, set yourself to do what is straight and good in God's eyes. Now, the reader at this point says to himself, the rules aren't enough. Just imagine that. The whole book of Shulchan Aruch isn't enough. Okay. But I'm loyal. I'm faithful. I pledge allegiance. So what else is it I'm supposed to do? Well, just do what's straight and good in God's eyes. How am I supposed to know that? If it's not in the rule book anywhere, how am I supposed to know what it is? Clearly, the Ramban is not telling us flip a coin. Do what your spirit moves you to do. No, the Torah here is giving you a description. It's got to be straight and good in God's eyes. On the other hand, it's got to outrun the whole of the formulated tradition, written and oral. So it must be coming from somewhere else that is a valid piece of the tradition, but transcending the written and the oral, transcending the linguistic. And in Leviticus, I think it's chapter 19, verse 2, be holy, the Torah says, be holy. And the Ramban there makes the same remark, and he actually cross-references the two remarks. Only here he says it's talking about personal behavior. The Torah has rules for personal behavior, but they aren't enough. Imagine that, they aren't enough. Because a person could be a disgusting, degraded personality fully within the rules of the Torah. Novel versus the Torah is one of the most famous phrases that the Ramban ever wrote. For example, he says, we have rules of kashrus. All different kinds of foods. What is to prevent a person from buying 3 pounds of steak and taking 3 quarts of wine and eating and drinking himself into a stupor? Where in the rules of kashrus does it say you can't do that? Oh. Doesn't say. Therefore, the Torah adopted the same split-level strategy. Number one, certain minimum rules, up to which everyone has to live. Then the Torah said, in addition to all the rules that I told you, behold, seek to infuse your personal life with a level of holiness. And a second time, the reader says, how do I do that? How do I know what to do? Third example, we have many cases where we are confronted with conflicts between mitzvahs. Some of them are easy, where the conflict is built into the system or built into normal everyday life. The system has rules for resolving those conflicts. But there are others that are more subtle, cases where there is a kind of social breakdown, but not a total social breakdown. There's a danger of violating a law. For example, as some of you know, when Rosh Hashanah comes out on Shabbos, we don't blow the shofar. Why not? has nothing to do with musical instruments. The musical instrument band is only rabbinic, and the shofar is long intercedes the that band. The rabbis wouldn't have destroyed the mitzvah of the shofar for that day, just for the sake of a general ban on musical instruments. No, the Gemara says the reason is this. Blowing the shofar is complicated. Getting the notes right and the breathing right is complicated. We could imagine a person who was very dedicated, very concerned that he do it right, and he wants an expert to certify that he has blown the notes correctly. So he brings his shofar to the expert and has the expert listen to him while he blows it to tell him whether he blew it correctly or not. Now, if Rosh Hashanah happens to be Shabbos, and if he will have to carry the shofar to a public domain, he will violate the Shabbos laws. Inadvertently, to be sure, not on purpose. He's a good guy. He wants to do things right. But he's so concerned about shofar, he might forget about Shabbos. Because of that possibility, because of the possibility that some small minority of Jews might inadvertently carry the shofar to a public domain, the rabbis made a rule that the whole of the Jewish people will not blow shofar the first day of Rosh Hashanah that year, which is the biblical mitzvah. Now, who told them to do this? How did they figure this out? How did they weigh it up? The definite loss of the biblical mitzvah of shofar for the whole people that year versus the mere possibility of a tiny minority inadvertently violating Shabbos. Who told them this is more important? It's not written anywhere. This is what you call a judgment. It requires judgment. It requires an evaluation. One that can't really, it isn't in words, and it isn't based on legal precedent and legal reasoning. It's rather judging the global situation and coming to the conclusion this is what's needed. Still, this is not regarded as arbitrary. My guts tell me this is the right thing to do. Your guts don't. Let's vote. This is regarded as a grasp of the reality of the situation. That's why for centuries there was no such ban, and then the Sanhedrin put into practice such a ban because the level of danger became acute enough for the Sanhedrin to feel that it was the right time to take action. So this playoff, one mitzvah versus another mitzvah, some of you know that the Gemara Gittin says the reason the temple was destroyed is because the Sanhedrin made a mistake of such a calculation. Somebody wanted to sabotage the sacrificial system, someone who had a grudge, and what they really should have done is kill him. Because he was operating on behalf of the Romans. The Romans were using this to test whether or not the Jews would accept the Roman sacrifice. He was putting the Jewish community in danger, and they should have killed him. But there was a discussion, and a certain person had objections, and as a result of it, the Gemara says that the temple was destroyed. It was a question of weighing up the consequences on both sides, and they made a mistake, a wrong calculation. But it's clear from the fact that these questions are discussed that there's supposed to be a calculation. There's supposed to be a judgment. So that's the third case where you see the tradition relying on information and judgment that is not put into words. Fourth case, in the way of the path of the just, so-called by Lutzato, that is Yisrael, chapter 18, he discusses what is a chosid. Okay, don't get nervous. The Chab is not a chosid. He lives at the simultaneously with the origin of the Chassidic movement, but he lives in Italy and then in Amsterdam, and at that time the Chassidic movement was just starting in Eastern Europe. I doubt that either knew about the other at the time. It was the beginning of the 18th century. But chosid is a classical concept. The Tanakh mentions chosid many times. So Ramchal defined the chosid as follows. some people look at Judaism as a rule book. Their goal is to, at the end of the day, be able to check off all the rules. When did I do rule 1? 8:55, check it off. When did I do rule 2? 9:06, check it off. Rule 3, 6:35, check it off. And if I can get through to the end of all the rules with checks, I made my day. I satisfied all the rules. That is not a chassid. A chassid doesn't look to satisfy all the rules. A chassid looks to use every minute of his day in service of God. To find some way in everything that he does to please God. That's the chassid's goal. Which means that he will want to please God and will be successful in pleasing God, if he's really a chassid, in ways that are not formulated in the rules, that go beyond the rules. And again, the reader says, well, if they go beyond the rules, how does he know what to do? Where does he get a clue what to do? And yet, being a chassid is a religious goal, it's a spiritual goal. So there must be something to do, and there must be some way to get the judgment what should be done, even though it goes beyond all the rules. So this is evidence that the tradition recognizes a non-verbal dimension. Now, let me take a few minutes just to talk about this in general philosophical terms. If you're not interested in this, you can put your head down and close your eyes. That'll be all right. I'll give somebody to give you a nudge when we get back to the Torah sources. If you can't say it, if you can't express it, if you can't put it into words, can it really have any validity? Can it be true? Can it be valid? Can it be right? Might one not say that if you can't put it into words, it's just a matter of feeling, it's just a matter of intuition, even though that's misusing the word intuition. It's purely subjective. If you could tell me what it's supposed to mean in words, so that we could check whether it's true or false, whether it's you have reason, you don't have reason. But if you're telling me that if there are no rules, no words at all, how could that be valid? How could that be right? That's what I want to show you. That it could be right and it could be valid. Someone once asked a great sculptor how he sculpts marble. Marble, you see, has a special problem because the color isn't one color. There are veins in the marble. Now, you get the block of marble that you see from the outside. When you get finished chopping, you'd like the veins in the marble to contribute to the statue. You know, if you're chiseling a statue of an elephant, you don't want vertical stripes in the elephant because vertical stripes make things light and airy. Ask clothes designers. You know, people who are chubby, they design clothes with vertical stripes. So now, they asked him, how do you sculpt marble? How do you know what it's going to look like? How do you know to make it look right? And he said, well, if I'm sculpting an elephant, I just cut away everything that doesn't look like elephant. And then I have an elephant left. That's it. That's how I do it. At the risk of reading in, I want to suggest that the sculptor was trying to communicate two very important facts, two very fundamental facts. Number one, the sculptor doesn't do it by rules. It isn't as if Michelangelo wrote a hidden set of rules to sculpt, and it is passed down from generation to generation to a small elite. And these are the really great sculptors, because when they have a problem, they run to the book. And look it up in the book and say, oh, yeah, it's like that. Good, terrific. Put it back in the sink, don't let anybody see it. And they give it a smash, and then it does okay. That's not how you sculpt. There aren't rules for sculpting. And indeed, there aren't rules for lots and lots of things that we do in life. When I was a freshman in college, everyone had to take English composition, because it was assumed that we were mostly illiterate, which was not far from the truth. One exercise I will never forget. The professor said, I want each of you to write out a list of rules for tying your shoes. She gave us about 20 minutes to write out this list. At the end, she said, swap lists. So we exchanged lists. Now she said, each of you read the rules that you got from your friend's list and use it to tie your shoes. Not a single pair of two shoes got tied. You don't tie your shoes by following a set of rules.
Not only don't you follow a set of rules, but when you're asked to produce a set of rules, you can't do it.
Now, as a matter of fact, there are people who are trained to do this. There's a discipline called task analysis, which breaks down simple activities into tying your shoes is about 450 rules.
Why do they do this?
For learning disabled children or children with coordination problems, and you have to break it down into the very elementary steps.
But you and I don't do that. We couldn't even do it if we tried. You have to be trained to do this.
So obviously, when you tie your shoes, you're not following rules. And the same is true for signing your signature and riding a bike. Myriads of things that we do without following rules. Indeed, some of these things are very primitive. Even, let's say, basic perception. When I was teaching at Johns Hopkins, I had a friend who was teaching in the applied physics lab at Johns Hopkins. That's a place where they make satellites and remote control bombs and other friendly things like that. And he told me that in the United States Navy, they had a problem. Certain schools of fish, when a submarine uses its sonoscope to sweep the area underwater, certain schools of fish look like enemy submarines. That's the way they show up on the sonoscope. Well, you don't want to waste your torpedoes on fish, right? So it's very important to know the difference between fish and submarines. There were two people in the Navy at that time who could reliably distinguish between the fish and the submarines, and then one died. So they were left with one. I asked him, well, why don't you just get him to explain what the difference is? And he said, they thought of that. The Navy actually thought of that. And they asked him, what's the difference? And he said, well, the difference is this. The fish look like fish, and submarines look like submarines. I mean, that's the way they look. He couldn't say in words what they look like. It just was obvious to him that this is the way they look. So the first thing this sculptor was teaching us is a great deal of what we do is not done through rules. We don't have the rules, and we couldn't make the rules if we needed to. And the second thing he was teaching us is that these things that we do are objective knowledge. Objective, testable, provable knowledge. Because when you set yourself to tie your shoes, they get tied. With the same slip knot every time. It isn't as if sometimes it comes out of square knot, and sometimes it comes out of loop, and sometimes you get lost, you lose the ends. No, every time you do it, you can predict the result. The result will be that they're not of a certain kind tied the way you wanted it tied. So you obviously have some objective knowledge of how to deal with the world so as to get a certain result. And say with signing your name and riding a bicycle, this fellow who looked at the sonoscope, it was easy to test him. We, on the outside, can say, point it towards the submarine, point it towards fish, and see what he says. And he gets it right every time. So obviously he knows something about the way these things look that we don't know, because we test it that way. So a great deal of what we know about the world, we do not put into words. And yet it is objective knowledge. Indeed, the thought that all cognition goes on in language, all thinking goes on in language, and without language you can't think, is a little silly on the face of it. I'll bet everyone in this room has had the experience, numerous times, of trying to put a thought into words. Trying to find the right words to express what you want to say. And you try. Try these words, those words. Maybe if you're sitting with somebody, you've had a common experience, you heard a concert or something, trying to describe it. You suggest words, and he says, not exactly because of this and this. You say, well, how about that? He suggests words. Until finally, you come up with a formula of words that satisfies you. Now, if you didn't have a thought before you looked for the words, how could you tell which words were right and which words were wrong? Obviously, you must have had some thought. The thought you were trying to put into words. So to say that all thought is in words, and without words you can't think, is a little bit dumb. Even though, as I say, that's what we were sort of trained to say. There is a deeper question, which shouldn't be confused here, and that is, can there be thoughts without symbols? That's a deeper question. I don't know the answer to that question. It's so deep that people aren't really even discussing it at this point, they're discussing it only indirectly.
But thought without language?
It seems obvious that there is such a thing.
And that thought can be accurate or inaccurate, valid or invalid, justified or unjustified, even though it isn't in words.
Yeah.
Can also babies be used as proof?
Can also what?
Babies.
I'll tell you, it's hard to know what they're thinking. What is
they
thinking?
Well, I mean, they do have actions and actions like this and thoughts and they don't...
What age babies are you talking about?
Infants.
What age infants?
Before they start talking.
Oh, before they start talking, that's for sure. I mean, babies at the age of 8 months or 9 months or 10 months are already solving complex problems. But you need some kind of... You need some, huh? How to get the toy away from my older brother without his seeing me so he won't clobber me. He crawls over and, you know... I saw, I mean, we have 6 children and 30 grandchildren, so I have some experience in this matter. I noticed a child, before the age of a year, fall in such a way as to hurt, I think it was a boy or a girl, and look around to see if anybody was looking. You've seen that. And if they don't see anybody looking, they won't cry. And if they see somebody looking, they'll cry. Go figure that out. They're not so dumb. But you got to have some kind of evidence of thought. And indeed, in those cases, it's clear that they're thinking, and although they probably have very little passive vocabulary, there's no active vocabulary at all. So, I think it's a certain stage, yes. Indeed, there's plenty of evidence that animals think. So, the claims for animal language are, you know, greatly exaggerated beyond belief. There's an experiment they do with chimpanzees. They hang a banana, a cluster of bananas from the ceiling, and in the room there's a table and a chair separated, and, you know, goes, and often enough the chimpanzee will pull the table over, put the chair on the table, and climb up and get the bananas. He's clearly thinking and solving the problem there, right? Even though he hasn't got any language to do it. So there's no serious question that can be thought without language. And if there can be thoughts without language, then there can be accurate and inaccurate thought, valid and invalid thought, better justified, more poorly justified, true and false, to apply to all of these things. In fact, even when you are using language, you're also using non-linguistic abilities. I don't know how many of you have had the terrible misfortune to study math, but if you did, you probably remember having to solve problems. Now, the problem is a set of words. The solution will be some calculation in symbols. The only thing that's missing is, how do you find the solution? Is there a recipe at the back of the book? You know, follow this step, follow that step, follow that step, follow that step. There can't be a recipe for solving mathematical problems. Such a thing has been demonstrated to be impossible. That sounds crazy, I know. What can I tell you? One of the greatest geniuses of the 20th century, a logician named Kurt Gödel, proved the theorem that in the study of numbers, just addition of them, and subtraction, multiplication, you can formulate problems, and there's no method. There's no universal method for solving the problems. It's even worse. That's even worse. I'm talking about now just statements using just the 4 basic mathematical operations. And quantification. Of course, they do very simple problems. But I'm talking about propositions. Like, is there an infinity of twin primes? You know what twin primes are? Twin primes are primes that differ by 2, like 11 and 13, or 17 and 19. Now, do they go on forever or not? No one knows. Here's a proposition I communicated to you in 20 seconds. How complicated could it be? No one knows. For hundreds of years, people have been thinking about this, and no one has been able to prove it true or prove it false.
Well, if the numbers are infinite, then why can't there be infinite primes as well?
There definitely are infinite primes. That was proved by the Greeks 2,300 years ago. But there's an infinity of twin primes. Primes are infinite. That's easy. I think Pythagoras proved that. But we're talking about ones that differ by 2. Well, because typically, as you go out further and further, since you have more divisors, the time starts thinning out. They get further and further apart. And the more divisors you have, the easier it is to divide a number. Just recently... Huh? You did take it? No, just recently, by the way, someone solved a very famous problem. How to determine whether an arbitrary number is prime. Two relatively amateur mathematicians solved this problem recently with a 7-page paper. Oh, the whole mathematical world is on its ear. And a fairly simple method for deciding this. And this would be very important for cryptography, because you could take a gigantic number and disguise it as a prime and use it to base your encryption on. And people who want to crack the code, it would be almost impossible for them to find the number. Anyway, let me just finish the point that I'm making here. So, the problem is in words, and the solution is in words. But the method whereby you get from the problem to the solution is not in words. It can't be in words. It can't be in words. So even when you're working with words, you need to lean on non-linguistic abilities. Because some people regularly solve these problems, and the rest of us sit in awe and read their results. These people who regularly solve these problems have some grasp of the mathematical reality that the rest of us don't have. And it's not a linguistic grasp. Same thing with chess.
Can you raise the thing to figure out 1 plus 1?
Probably 0. It doesn't take any figuring at all. So it's not a thing that you figure out. Figure out requires steps and retracing steps, making mistakes and correcting them. I don't think there are any ways to figure out 1 plus 1. Maybe you mean something else, but figure out means I'm confronted with a difficulty, I have to try different hypotheses, I have to reject this because it didn't work, and I've tried something else, then I'll try two together, for 1 plus 1, none of that applies.
No, it's the same way, like, I was taught 1 plus 1 is 2. Maybe some kid in Africa or wherever was taught 1 plus 1 is 2, but with some weird other formula. I would never understand his thought process.
I doubt it very much. this is very, very chic in the multicultural liberal establishment, but I doubt it very much. And you would have to imagine someone who is not capable of seeing the most obvious fact that we can think of immediately. He couldn't see it immediately. I think that's just extravagant nonsense. Anyway, so let's come back to where we are. We are now saying that ideas that are not put into words can be true, valid, justified, right, appropriate. And the fact that they aren't put into words shouldn't frighten us. And we have evidence that the Jewish tradition contains such materials. Now, let's ask, if this dimension, this nonverbal dimension, does exist, where is it? We know where the verbal is, to books, to lectures. Where is the nonverbal? I think we should go back to the sculptor. Where is the sculptor's ability to sculpt? Where is it? It's in his brain, it's in his fingertips, it's in his neurons, it's in his muscles. He embodies it. It's in him. So likewise, this non-linguistic dimension is in people who possess it. They embody it. Okay, how you learn it? Well, how would you learn sculpting? You're not going to get a book. No, you go to a sculptor and you ask to be accepted as a student. And you watch. You watch what he does. You try your best to imitate. You sculpt in front of him and he gives you gentle encouragement like, no, you dope, not to the hammer with the chisel, you know, little things like that. And if you're talented, you pick it up. And if you're not talented, you go drive the bus. Because it requires talent to sort of pick it up while you watch it. Some people get that talent and some people don't have that talent. And the same thing is true here. The non-linguistic dimension of the tradition is embodied by certain people, and you get it by associating with them, davening with them, spending Shabbos with them, learning Torah with them, watching them do chesed for other people, experiencing how they serve God.
Know what it says about Joshua? Joshua became the leader of the Jewish people after Moses because the Torah says he was never absent from Moses' tent. But Yomush, Yosef Mina Olam. It doesn't say because he mastered his philosophy or understood all of his laws or asked brilliant questions in Shir. He did all of that. But that's not the reason why he qualified to be the next leader. He never left Moses alone. He followed him around. Because he wanted to absorb from Moses not only the linguistic teachings, but the non-linguistic teachings. He wanted them both. He wanted to see how does Moses greet people and how does Moses pray. How does Moses eat, and how does he bench after he eats, and how does he serve God? So the non-linguistic is something that you absorb by being by interacting with the people who possess it. Now we come to the crucial question, crucial theoretically, and here's where many people make a mistake. What is the origin? What is the origin of the non-linguistic dimension? Here, many people are tempted to say that it must be intuition. It's non-linguistic, so it wasn't taught in lectures. It wasn't written down in books. So it must be intuition. A person must just sort of feel what's right. Feel what needs to be done. Now, that's a little difficult to say. Go back to the verses. Do what is straight and good in God's eyes. And I'm going to know that because I feel that way. I'm so objective. I'm so holy. I'm so godlike. That if it feels that way in my heart, it's got to be right. It's a little suspicious. It's actually Protestant Christianity. And it really has very little to do with us. No. The origin of the non-linguistic is exactly the same as the origin of the linguistic. Namely, prophecy. This is absolutely crucial to understand. It is an injection from God into the world. It is not a matter of bubbling up from inside on the basis of your intuition. Intuition can lead you desperately, desperately astray. And the way it works is this. Prophecy is not like getting a postcard from God. It's not even like hearing a recorded announcement from God. Prophecy is a total experience. Other than Moses, a prophet lost complete control of himself. He was flattened onto the ground. He lost control of his body, lost control of his senses, lost control of his mind. Only Moses could take prophecy standing up, conscious, in control, and react. Every other prophet was simply flattened by it. And when he got up off the ground, he wasn't the same person anymore. These are the literal words of the Tanakh. When Saul, before he becomes king, meets Samuel the prophet, and Samuel says to him, I'm informing you of a career change. instead of minding the flocks of donkeys that belong to your father, you're going to be king. And I want you to go to such and such a place. And on the way, you will meet a roving band of prophets. In Israel in those days, that's what you had in the hills. Roving bands of prophets. You'll meet them, and you too will prophesy. You will be overturned into another person. This is what prophecy meant. Prophecy meant overturning the person into another person. He became a new person. I don't mean that he wasn't related to the old person. I don't mean he lost his memory or his character. But an experience so powerful and so fundamental was added to his history to the point that he looked at the world differently and he interacted with the world differently. So that this difference in his personality, in his perceptions, and in his reactions is the origin of the non-linguistic dimension of the tradition. Now, how many prophets were there? How widespread was prophecy? How much input of this type did we get? Well, as you all know, especially coming up to Shavuos at Sinai, the whole Jewish people were prophets. Every one of us experienced prophecy. And at the crossing of the Red Sea, other times. Then,
from that generation until the end of prophecy, 1,000 years later, there were 1,200,000 Jewish prophets.
So says the Talmud.
600,000 men and 600,000 women. Which means that prophecy was very common. Divide up 1,200,000 prophets over 1,000 years, and it means at any period of time, you have hundreds and hundreds of prophets living simultaneously. So much so that the Ramban says a Jew living at that time never went to a doctor. Because your physical condition is a symptom of your spiritual condition. And if you have a physical problem, that's a symptom of some spiritual defect. And medicine runs on the principle that you don't treat symptoms, you treat the disease. So don't go to somebody who's going to fix the physical symptoms. Go to somebody who can identify the disease. Who would that be? That would be a prophet. Go to the prophet and say, listen, I got a toothache, I've got a headache, my toe is bleeding. And the prophet will say, well, this is happening to you because of such and such a failure of mitzvahs. And the Jew would fix up the failure of mitzvahs, and the physical symptom would go away. As long as we had prophets, that was the methodology. There were enough prophets to go around so that everybody could solve his medical problems by going to prophets. It means everyone interacted with prophets. So, if you ask, what is the origin of the non-linguistic dimension? The answer is, the whole of the Jewish people had prophecy at Sinai, so they all had an injection. For the following 1,000 years, every Jew either was a prophet or lived in close proximity to prophets, and interacted with prophets. So there was a gigantic infusion of this non-linguistic dimension. And this non-linguistic dimension is what enables the Jewish tradition to face the problems that we stated at the beginning. How do we know what is straight and good in God's eyes if the rules don't tell us? How do we know what it means to be holy if the rules don't tell us? How can they make a calculation that one mitzvah is more important than another mitzvah, or this complex of mitzvahs is more important than that complex of mitzvahs, when there's no explicit rule for comparing them, no way to set up evaluation of them? How can a person know what it means to be a chassid? To say, I know what God wants from me now. He wants me to do this, and this will please him. This will please God, even though he didn't tell me. Because that's the essence of a chassid. The essence of a chassid is to do something to please God when he wasn't told to do it. So how can you know it'll please God? The answer is, it comes down through the non-linguistic tradition. It means that God really did give us an indication of what it is, but not through the linguistic.
What about the non-Jews? You know what the topic is specifically, and how to deal with the traditional problems
with
non-linguistic issues.
Non-Jews go back ultimately to prophecy also. Adam had prophecy, Noah and his children had prophecy. So there's an injection of the non-linguistic for the non-Jewish world as well.
So would you say that Jews would have more of a higher degree of that?
Infinitely more, further. Infinitely more, obviously. That's quite right. But they're not totally devoid of it. Now, let's ask this question. How are the linguistic and the non-linguistic related? It's all information. It's all ideas. It's all reality. How are they related? Is it just two things you need to know? You need to know the laws of Kashrus, you need to know the laws of Shabbos. Just, you know, but if you don't know one of them, you're missing something. The answer is no. The two form an integrated whole. So that if you're missing one, you don't really get the other one either. Each one is necessary to correctly understand the other. In one direction this is obvious, in the other direction not so obvious, but also true and very important. But let's imagine a person who doesn't know the linguistic, but he is a seeker of inspiration. He's a person who wants to experience saintliness. So he goes around the world looking for people who are regarded as saints and spends time with them trying to see, you know, what they do. Now, let's imagine him attached to a tzaddik. What does he see? And how does he interpret what he sees? Poor person comes in, and the tzaddik supplies the poor person with all of his needs. Doesn't just give him $10 and show him the door. Is that the minimum Jewish law? Is that an optional interpretation of the law? Is that going far beyond the law? If you don't know that, you don't know how to rate what the tzaddik is doing. You don't know what it means. In Lakewood, Rav Aaron Cutler's at the Tzaddik Tebracha, they had a chip of the chickens. And there was a question of the kashrus of the chickens. So one of the people there said, look, Rav Aaron, this is Lakewood, you know, the pinnacle of American Jewry, the standard for American Jewry. We can't use those chickens. His question about whether they're kosher, Rav Aaron said, and on the basis of that question, you're going to waste charity money? The people who support this institution are supporting it with charity money. Are they paying for stringencies and kashrus? No. They have to eat the chickens. So now, when you see him accepting that those chickens, is this a great thing to do? A compromise? A poor thing to do? How do you know? If you don't know the rules, you can't evaluate the action. If you don't know the rules, watching a tzaddik act is sort of like watching chess without knowing the rules of chess. You don't know what a good move is, you don't know what a bad move is, you don't know what a brilliant move is, you don't know what a dumb move is. Except later when the guy gives up, he loses the game. So if you don't have linguistic, you're not going to understand the non-linguistic. Your observations will be incompetent. That's fairly obvious, but the other way around is also true. If you don't have the non-linguistic, you can't understand the linguistic. Here's an illustration from real life. This goes back, you know, so many years, yeah. It's before you were born, long before you were born. 40 years ago. There was a young woman studying at a college in the Boston area. She was not religious sense. There were no religious people at her university. And she didn't know much about Jewish belief or Jewish observance. Somehow she got hold of Diane Goodfield's book, The Sabbath, which is a wonderful, wonderful introduction to the Sabbath. And in it, he goes through the 39 forbidden categories of activity on Shabbos. She told me she read this book, and her reaction to it was horror. You can't use the telephone, you can't write a letter, you can't open your mail, you can't turn on and off the lights, adjust the heat, you can't take a shower, you can't cook breakfast, you can't take out the garbage, I mean, you can't write. She said, it sounds obsessive compulsive. The only thing that you can't do. And she said she was sure that trying to live that way would cause a person to become neurotic. Can I do this? Can I do this? When did I transgress last? You know, it took her months to get up the courage to try to keep Shabbos. And remember, she's there without any friends, without any Shabbos meals where you can sing and enjoy, without words of Torah, without fellowship, all by herself. Finally, she got up courage and she tried. And she reported that the experience was the exact opposite of what she anticipated. Instead of feeling, I can't do this, she felt, I don't have to do this. She realized that her life was programmed with constant interruptions, programmed with constant demands, which prevented her from having time to think calmly and in a connected way where she is, where she's going, what she wants, what she really feels. Can you walk past your mailbox, see letters inside, and leave them for tomorrow? Just, you know, I won't answer them today. I'll just put them tomorrow. But somebody might need me. Yeah, I'll need you tomorrow also. If there were a mail strike, would you run down to the sorting facility and hunt for your letters? Because somebody might need me. No, you're saying it'll come tomorrow. You know, you wouldn't be so. One of the great Musar exponents in Europe only opened his mail Saturday night.
didn't want to be disturbed the rest of the week.
Ha! Turn off your cell phone.
Boy, that's a struggle, huh?
But, you know, somebody might call! So what?
What do you do when you go to sleep? You keep it on next to your pillow because somebody might call? I hope not.
I hope you are more merciful to yourself than that.
But, you know, especially in class, you know. And then, you know, you have to answer.
Why?
Call the guy back an hour from now.
The number stays in the phone.
He just stays in my phone.
Didn't call him back an hour.
No, it's calling. You know, I have to answer. So she said she discovered a very precious quality of experience that the Shabbos provided for her. Now, here's the key to the story. She said, after she had the experience, she went back and reread the book. And she understood it in an entirely different way. Instead of obsessive, compulsive control, she read it as strategies for producing a certain very precious experience. If she hadn't had the experience, she would not have been able to appreciate the laws of Shabbos. Because much of the appreciation of the laws is experiential. In a way. Jewish studies programs at various universities, as far as I know, I may be wrong, there may be exceptions, but as far as I know, do not take students on field trips. In anthropology have field trips, in sociology have field trips, but not in Jewish studies programs. Well, how are you supposed to understand what a Jewish wedding is, what Jewish study is, if you haven't attended a yeshiva or girls haven't attended a seminary? To understand Jewish communal organization and communal feeling, if you haven't attended a funeral, and seen what goes on and how the mourners are comforted. If you haven't observed Jewish life, how can you understand the laws that you read? But then, of course, the objection will be, we're running a university program, if we take people to religious performances, that'll be sort of like, you know, teaching religion. On the other hand, a Jewish studies program should be afraid of teaching religion. I don't know, let the academics sort that out. But in the meantime, educationally, it's incompetent. It's incompetent. Because you can't understand the rules unless you have the experience that goes with it. So the experiential, the non-linguistic, has to go together with the linguistic in order to make an integrated whole. Now, in the last 3 minutes, I want to tell you the real subject of this year. I didn't publicize it because if I did, maybe nobody would have come. The real subject of this year is why you need a Rebbe. Why every Jew needs a personal Rebbe. I'm not talking about this Hasidic or Mishnagdic or Sfadi or Yeke or, gosh, should I include my Hungarians? Borderline case. Everyone needs it. Why? Because if all you've got is books and lectures, you haven't got the non-linguistic. Or maybe a piece of it you have, but not enough. Not enough. By the way, the verse in the prophets, I always forget where, let your eyes see your teachers. Why? Because there's more that goes into teaching than just words. There's the expression of the words, facial expression, the body language, which communicates attitudes and values, and all of that is part of the teaching. So it's not enough to get somebody else's notes. I once taught at the Hebrew University. There was a whole industry of producing complete notes because many of the students had graduated from the army and they were supporting families and they couldn't come to class. The only time they showed up was for the final exam. Somebody had to produce the notes for them. But they lost that. Because part of the teaching is the expression of the teaching. You need to have someone that you can look up to, that you can use as an example and an inspiration, and who, through talking to you, can communicate to you, to your individual life, what this non-linguistic dimension means for your development. If you don't have that, you're missing out on the non-linguistic, and you're missing out on the non-linguistic, that even if you grasp the linguistic, it's going to suffer. You will not have a total integrated Jewish existence. Questions?
Yeah.
Did you ever hear of the color argument when someone looks at, I know now the whole sort of topic switched, but the thing like, one's very rough, but I didn't get it then. I see red one way. Another guy,
it's called the inverted spectrum. Where? Right. How do you know that the other person's qualitative experience is like yours or unlike yours? It's a classical problem in philosophy.
It kind of sounded like what Ernie was saying tonight about how one person will interpret one thing one way. And something that you said maybe triggered this argument. Yeah, maybe think of it. Like,
well,
some similarities.
I wouldn't want to bring that in. The examples I gave, my point was that there could be objectively correct information. Now, I tie my shoelaces without words, but they get tied the same way every time. So this is a piece of knowledge you can check and test. The point of the inverted spectrum argument is it's a skeptical argument. There's no way to test whether your experience is qualitatively similar to mine or different from mine.
And I remember what it was when you said about the summer reading. One guy will see it, he sees that this is school of fish.
Right.
I see this as red. But another guy...
There's an enormous difference, because with the school of fish, I can check. I can check objectively to see whether he's getting it right or not. Right? I aim the thing at fish, and I ask him, what does he see? He says, submarine, you know, let him become a bus driver. Right? Here, the whole point of the inverted spectrum argument is that there's nothing you can do to check. And then, for certain schools of philosophy, if there's nothing you can do to check, there's no reality, and yet here there seems to be a reality, and that's where the discussion gets. You know, that's how it goes. So I'm not talking about that. I'm not talking about skeptical problems of inner experience. I'm talking about the fact that with your experience, you grasp things about the world, and then you can test them about the world. You know, it's like reading a person's mood.
Mood.
Right. You look at a person, he's obviously not happy. But is he depressed? Is he anxious? Is he worried? What is he? Now, some people are very good at this. They look at the person, they say, well, there's a little, it's a mixture of anxiety and depression. And I say, yeah, it looks like he has an upset stomach. And why are you reading so much into it? Now, when we interact with the person, we can check. We can see what's bothering him. We can ask him, how's your stomach? He says, oh, don't ask about my stomach. Stomach is fine. You know, my life isn't terrible, let alone my stomach. So he said, well, oh, sorry, you know, I thought he had an upset stomach, but I guess you're right, something else. So here, you're reading his mood on the basis of what you see, and then you interact with him and check and see whether you're right or you're wrong. So here you can check objectively whether you got it or you didn't get it. Now, some people are gifted in getting it. They become psychologists or social workers. And the people who aren't gifted become mathematicians. Why should they ruin other people's lives by not getting it? But here, it's a question of perception. It's like intuition, like I said before, which is a misused word. But you can check it objectively.
So how would you check objectively the argument for non-public? How would you check that objectively?
I'll tell you. There's relative objectivity.
There's no basis for that in how often necessarily or maybe.
Oh, you have to understand what it means to have a basis for something. There is they used to say like this. If the Ran was one of the great medieval commentators, if the Ran would try to prove a point by citing specific passages in the Talmud, so then I can see what his arguments are. Try to enter into a dialogue about it. But if Ron says merely, it seems to me that this is what it is, then I can't fight with him. I won't even be able to enter the discussion. Why? Because we have a principle of objectivity, relative objectivity. If A's knowledge and understanding completely contain B's and go beyond, then A's opinion is more objective than B's.
How are you going to prove that?
Expecting you with the Ran? Is that a Shaila? Right. You read what the Ran wrote, and you read what the works that, and the variety of material that he did, a parish on almost all the Shas, the Drushas of Ran, which are filled with all sorts of philosophical questions, and you know that he knew infinitely more than you did. So when he says, nearly, what am I going to do? How am I going to fight with him?
I haven't got the sources to fight with him. On the other hand, somebody on that level could fight with him. Right? I mean, the Rambam fought with the Rambam, the Rabbi Hillel fought with the Rambam 200 years later, 250 years later, and it's not impossible to fight, but you have to be on a par. So in terms of objectivity, when A's knowledge and understanding objectively include B's, A's judgment is more reliable than B's. That's a test we use in all of life. We use it in automotive engineering, we use it in mathematics, we use it in military science, we use it everywhere. No reason why I shouldn't fly here as well. Yeah.
Doesn't that apply to, basically everything in sight can be relatively objective?
Even what, sorry?
Even sight.
So, sight?
Yes. So no matter what, it's all really relative.
Well, all relative. I'm setting out a criterion of objective preference. So it's relative in the sense that A is taller than B is relative. It's relative that A is taller relative to B. That's an objective fact that A is taller than B.
Okay.
By saying the word relative, it doesn't mean it's all free play. On the contrary. It means that it's a relationship. It's a relational fact, and the fact is an objective fact.
Okay, so, the other point that I wanted to get to is, I mean, the only thing that you seem to mention that contested the whole argument on why you wouldn't need a rabbi is because the argument that everything can be expressed in words. I mean, were you saying that was the main argument against
I'm saying that once you recognize that there is a non-linguistic dimension, and that non-linguistic dimension is embodied in people, then you know that you have to seek it out in people. You can't get it from books, you can't get it from just from lectures, you have to do it by interacting with the people who have it.
Does anybody argue with that?
No, nobody argues with it. But as you say, when the tradition is presented officially, people talk about the written and the oral, and that's all they say. And I think it presents a very misleading picture. By the way, here's an example, a beautiful example. You can try this out on other people. A man is dying. There are people gathered around his bed, and the last words are, "I want you to take all my money and do with it the best possible thing." And he dies. Nope. It's a mitzvah to do what the person, dying person says to do. And he said, "Do with it the best possible thing." Ha! What do you do now?
Give it to the National Endowment for the Arts.
Right. Give it to burn down the National Endowment for the Arts. That would be a better suggestion, I think. I think it's Rabbi David Ordman. Ordman said, if you ask a Rosh Yeshiva, what is he going to say? Give it to Yeshiva. It's Talmud Torah connected Kulon. What can be more important? What guarantees the continuity of the Jewish people? You can hear the whole drasha, right? And you can talk about a doctor. If you're not healthy, how can you get on Torah? So the health is absolutely fundamental. You can't do that. Nutritionist, if you don't get good nutrition, you won't be healthy. If you won't be healthy, you can't get on Torah. So it's got to go to nutrition, right? Everyone will have a reason why his discipline is most important. Well, this question is raised in the Shulchan Aruch. I think it's the Maharam in the commentary in the Shulchan Aruch is brought down. And he says, the answer is, give it to the person's heirs. It's your share. That is, after all, the mitzvah the Torah says to do with money that's not otherwise designated. How could you do anything better than the mitzvah the Torah said to do with the money?
Well, this situation.
1 second. Now compare it with. 1 second, before you go on to other cases. Think of what's being said here. Everybody has a suggestion. The Rosh Hashiva has a suggestion, the doctor has a suggestion, and the nutritionist has a suggestion. I think the minute you hear the solution is obviously right. But we didn't think of it. The Maharam thought of it. Now I say, when I crack my head against that problem and get it wrong, I hear the Maharam's answer, and I see the Maharam is right, and he's obviously right, I just didn't think about it right, that's when I'm ready to fold my cards. If he tells me to do something, he's demonstrated that he has a greater grasp than I do. He understands much better than I do. Huh?
Torah says what to do. Would you have to think about it so hard? Torah says give it to the Yarshan.
Quite right. But nobody thinks of it. You didn't think of it. You didn't say it. Try it on other people and see what they say. See how many will think of it. Just make sure they haven't looked it up in the Maharam. Right? See, try it out. Try it out. I tried it out. I think in all the times I've tried it, only one person got it.
The question wasn't presented that he had kids.
This is it. By the way, every Jew has Yorshim, unless he's an unmarried ger who has no children. Every Jew has Yorshim. Ain't the bakas. Yeah.
This whole thing about you know, learning the behaviors and this sort of thing. Practically speaking, how is that done today if you don't have the privilege of growing up in a home infused with this sort of thing? I don't hear about, you know, rabbi apprenticeships and anything like that.
So there are two things. First of all, you don't have to get to the very top. Anybody who's far enough along ahead of you embodies more of this than you have, and you can pick it up from them. That's one of the reasons why the yeshiva encourages students to go out for Shabbos, and they'll place people in homes for Shabbos. You should be gathering as much experiential information as possible. Someday, you're going to have to set up your own homes. You're not going to do it on the basis of books. I encourage you, go out for Shabbos, observe how husband and wife interact with one another. If it looks good to you, take the husband aside and say, listen, I'm a Baal Teshuva, I don't come from this background. How are you? What are you doing? What are the principles? Where did you learn it? How can it be applied? How can I learn it? Pump these people. That's what they're there for. If you think the children behave well, ask them, what was your strategy for raising your children? You need this. This is the non-linguistic aspect of it. Okay.